and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 553. My name is Andrew Corse, and joining me today is Mr. Dave Neal. Dave, how are you, sir?
Hey, I'm good. Nice to be back on the show, Andrew. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be catching up with you because we'll be talking about British Superbikes and the start of the season that's coming up this weekend at Donington in 2018. I know you were out at Donington actually last week at the last official test for British Superbikes before the season got started. So it'll be great to catch up a little bit later with you and hear how that went. And we'll also be talking about round two of World Superbikes from the Chang International Circuit in Buriram, Thailand.
Sure. I've literally just thawed out from Donington Park last week. It was a very cold and very windy, very back end of wintry kind of day.
As it has been, I think, across the whole of Europe. We've had the same cold, pretty much single-digit temperatures here. It's only starting to brighten up and warm up now.
Spring is upon us. The bike racing season is well underway. The sun's shining, certainly up here in the wilds of North Lincolnshire, on the banks of the River Trent, as always. Blue skies, sunshine, double-digit figures, and the clocks have since gone forward, so the British summertime is upon us. It's my favourite time of year, and it's good to be back on the show and good to be back chatting with you as well.
So before we move on to the news, I just want to give a shout out to Gary Shavitt and say thank you very much, sir, for supporting us via Patreon. It's the new way that we have set up in place to help people support and improve the show. So, Gary, thank you very much. You, sir, are a scholar and a gent. One of the things I was looking ahead for the news, we were talking about this just before we came on show, that the Isle of Man TT organisers had their live launch via YouTube, which you got to see, I remember.
I did, yeah. They tend to stream it live every year. And this is the first year that Greenlight Television have taken over the hosting of the show since they took over the reins from North One TV, who've been producing the show for the last few years. Matt Roberts and Dave Moore from Greenlight TV did a great job. The setting at the Villa Marina, the riders they had on, the questions that were asked, it was a very friendly, very relaxed atmosphere in front of a live audience as well. Questions mainly from Matt and from Dave, not really taking any questions from the floor. The riders come along and, yeah, as Martin Jessup pointed out during it, it's like everybody says the same thing. And it's like, yeah, I've got the best package. Yes, I'm going to do this. Yes, I'm going to do that. But it was just interesting to see them sat there, and the interaction between John McGuinness and Josh Brooks, how that partnership is marrying up, was really interesting. The dynamics of that, I think, are going to work really well. Also with Hutchie and Lee Johnston for the Honda team for the roads this year. It was interesting to see the dynamics between the riders, and they all go there for the same reason. They're all there racing the clock. As much as they race each other, it's a time trial, as we know. But the more interesting piece has been, and certainly the reaction on social media and beyond, has been the announcement of the change in presenters for the TV coverage for this year. Gone are Craig Doyle, Jim Witt and Steve Parrish, and in come the very capable and very polished Matt Roberts. I think I did read that Steve Plater was making the jump from North One to Greenlight TV. The one that's seems to cause the most consternation is the addition of Jody Kidd. Have you read much about that?
I did. I mean, I saw that both of them were announced, and I guess it wasn't too much of a surprise to me to see, well, you know, let's have a female presenter alongside a guy, because you could level that accusation at them at previous years. It would have was a bit of a boys' club with almost, what, like kind of the four of them, five of them, you know, doing the presentation. So as I think the Isle of Man TT has gone from strength to strength, the coverage has also improved, and it's just finding a bigger and bigger audience. It strikes me that it seemed logical that they would incorporate some sort of female presenter and somebody, I don't know, who has previous form. I think Jody Kidd alongside Susie Perry are probably the sort of two other female presenters I would think and associate with motoring and motorcycling.
Sure, as a presenter, certainly. I mean, a lot of people remember Jody Kidd had a bit of a failed outing on a programme on the BBC not too long ago. And I think things like that stick in a lot of people's memory. And when you look at the ladies that are available that aren't presenters, your Maria Costellos and Jenny Tinmouth, as two prime examples of fast ladies around the Isle of Man, their input would be on a par with the likes of Buster Plater and maybe Jim Witt and Steve Parrish, because they've all been there and done it. But as much as what was the guy's name? Craig Doyle? Craig Doyle, that's the guy. I couldn't remember his name. Yeah. As much as Craig Doyle had never ridden the Isle of Man, neither's Matt, but his background is deeper than Craig Doyle's. So I think that they'll be able to work off each other. Me, I have no real preference. Matt's a great presenter. Jody, we'll wait and see. But certainly the other guys at support. I think there's Cam Donald that's coming alongside them as well, plus one more whose name escapes me. So they do have that knowledge there, but I think over the last few years of North One's coverage, they're used to the dynamics of Jim Witt and Steve Parrish. So it's the old thing. It's change, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is change. And people do like those personalities, Steve Parrish as well. I mean, he's a bit of an institution with his tours and things. To your point, I think you're right, bringing on sort of Maria or Jenny Tinmouth as expert talking head. I think, you know, there's definitely room for that. And that's a great idea. But I do think these types of programs to do well do need sort of tried and tested experienced presenters, which Matt Roberts certainly brings with his experience from MotoGP, from doing British Superbike. So, I mean, I think, you know, he's a good foundation to build. And it'll be interesting to see how the other people that they can find, you know, like you say, sort of build that chemistry.
And it will take time. The North One guys have been together 5, 6, 7 years before they, once they've taken over from Greenlight previously. It tends to alternate between the two production companies. But yeah, it's going to take time. It's almost like the guys riding the TT. You only get 2 weeks a year to build the knowledge and to build the confidence. So we'll see. We'll see what comes with it. We'll make our opinions afterwards, after the event, but to judge people before the event, I think from what we've seen on social media, it's a little bit disappointing. But you know, some people are just a little bit averse to change sometimes.
Yeah. The one thing I did see, though, going back to John McGuinness, is that obviously he's there with Brooks, but he'll also, if I understand, be joining forces with Michael Dunlop to ride in the Supersport on a CBR 600.
Yeah, very much so. They'd had conversations over the closed season about what to do, and will you, and John asking Michael, will you build me a bike? And Michael's like, are you serious? Said, yeah, so let's do it. So why not? And this shows the camaraderie between the riders, possibly not the greatest of camaraderie between Michael Dunlop and Ian Hutchinson, which was touched on during the...
There's still some bad blood there, I think, isn't there?
There is, yeah. And I think as John McGuinness said, he said, I don't get involved in all that side. He said, a lot of people, he said, it's the heat of battle after 2 hours in the saddle, racing your ass off around the 37 miles of road circuit. He said, all I'm bothered about, he says, just give me a beer and I'll tell you whatever you need to know. He said, but yeah, so there is quite a reasonable amount of animosity between Hutchinson and Dunlop still. But the more interesting thing that came out of that pairing, that Hutchie, he might not even be ready for the TT, you know.
Exactly. And this is what I heard. It's still about 50-50. I mean, he's still, that's his aim. That's still his ambition. But, you know, whether his recovery will allow him to do that. The article I was reading detailed a little bit more about the fact that they just, you know, essentially sort of almost removed his ankle and fused the bone.
That's right.
And then had to break it, his bone in a different place to put the fixator on to extend it to get the length back. I know he was out in Spain, I think, at the same time the British Superbike guys were testing, because he's having to use a right foot gear shift.
He has done since his original accident at Silverstone.
Yeah, because of having lost now that flexibility in his left ankle. So, yeah his plans are still up in the air. Like I say, McGuinness confirmed that he'll be riding the Supersport from Michael Dunlop prepared. He also said that he'd be riding a Super Twin, Ryan Farquhar's Super Twin, which is pretty much, they are the fastest Super Twins because he pretty much invented the category.
He did.
And also McGuinness then will also be on the Mugen. And This was talked about earlier as well, but I thought the fact that he is now also riding the Norton, for me, Norton aligning themselves with the TT, I just thought was sort of a genius marketing combination from them. You know, it would be hard to see Norton trying to release a proper full-on super sports bike to compete in either British Superbikes or World Superbikes. This just seemed perfectly in line, you know, that the fact that they could, you know, really try and make the TT event their own.
It is. And it's the two icons meeting, isn't it? It's the iconic Isle of Man TT races, the iconic British brand of Norton. Stuart Garner has done a fantastic job at building and building over time. I know we've discussed it with Martin at the time. We've spoken to Stuart about it at the London Bike Show last year when I spoke to him for 20 minutes or so. The original derision that it's an Aprilia in a Spondon frame. The evolution from that to where they are now with the Norton frame, and yes, they are still going to use the Aprilia engine because it works for them at the moment. The bringing on board of John McGuinness, who I hear had the opportunity to take the ride last year rather than Dave Johnson alongside Josh Brooks, but turned it down to remain with Honda, bringing back the loyalty side of things with Honda and how he's been treated over the last 10 months since the Northwest. Not well at all. Clearly he signed some kind of NDA, so he can't say anything.
My hope was that he was going to retire and sort of be a Honda ambassador. And given the fact that, you know, his accidents arguably were caused by technical problems with the bike, they weren't his riding.
It wasn't
fault,
his riding when the throttle opened all by itself.
Yeah, I was disappointed, I think, that Honda didn't end that partnership how properly and how I think a lot of other people agree it should have been. So when I found that he'd, you know, come up with this, the deal with Norton and everything, it just seemed perfect. That really just seemed to really sort of put everything back in order again.
And it will help to take Norton to that next level. I mean, looking at what Josh Brooks did last year and cracking 130 miles an hour in the senior. And if I remember from memory, somebody will correct me, I think he finished sixth overall on the Norton, but 130 mile an hour lap on that bike, and I think Dave Johnson did the same. Is fantastic. Dave Johnson's brought it on another level after the guys prior to that. Josh Brooks is still learning the track. He said he's still very, very, in his words, slow through certain sectors on the course. He's not quite nailed it as yet. But to bring John McGuinness onto that and for John to point Josh in the right direction and the chemistry that they had on the couch, I'm going to say settee, purely English description, but on the couch was clear to see. And the guys really get on well, and they have the common goal of taking the Norton and Stewart and the team as far as they'll go. So it's I'm looking forward to the TT. I'm looking forward to it very much, more so than the fact that it will be my first visit this year ever.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting. Yeah.
So we're going out on practice week on the Wednesday. So we get practice Thursday, Friday. We get to watch the Superbike TT, and then we fly back on the Saturday tea time. So it's literally a brief visit, but it just to be over there is going to be something special. I can't wait.
Well, it's a taste to sort of wet your whistle maybe to come back for another time. But just to get over the once, I think, and just experience the atmosphere, I think will be fantastic.
Yeah. Roll on the 30th of May.
Okay, so was there any other news items or anything that you spotted during the week that sort of piqued your interest?
It's been a reasonably quiet week, all told, hasn't it?
The only other thing I saw was, and still sort of staying with the TT, was that Michael Dunlop was not campaigning the Hawk Racing Suzuki. Sounds like he gave that a try earlier in the year, I think out at Cartagena.
He did. He had five bikes out there, didn't he?
Yeah, it sounds like he was not happy or disappointed. I think he has a real sense of, you know, how fast he needs these bikes to be. I mean, you remember how, you know, these bikes are just on full chat, top gear, you know, on full throttle. And I think he probably with his knowledge and experience, knows how fast this thing needs to be. And there was also some comments saying too that the support that was being promised wasn't sort of materializing. So it sounds like he's decided to try and find another solution.
I wonder if he's going to look for another BMW.
Could well be, but let's hope he doesn't leave it as late as he did last time.
No, there'll be something in a shed somewhere around the corner waiting to be pulled out, as he did with the Milwaukee Yamaha.
Hi, this is Future Andy, cousin of Future Harry. Just jumping in here to prove Dave completely right, as I was editing this, it was announced that Michael Dunlop will be running a BMW this year on the Roads campaign. He's teamed up with Taz Racing to race a Tyco BMW first in the Northwest 200 in preparation to then take that on and race it at the Senior. So back to your regularly scheduled programming.
One other thing, from the GP last week, I haven't had a chance to listen to the show last week. Did you guys cover the Lorenzo brake issue?
It was mentioned. I think they sort of about the brakes, but yeah, I did hear a little bit more after the fact that the mechanics actually went out to that corner and scoured the gravel traps because they did really realize that a component had broken.
Yeah.
And I understood they actually found, amazingly, like a broken piece of the brake pad.
Unheard
and this
of.
Is essentially what it, had failed, that somehow the Brembo brake pad had cracked, snapped, or whatever. And so this was the source of his brake issue.
But again, what is happening with Jorge? It's a struggle. It's a struggle for him. Did you say you'd found some news this week about his rider aid, his rider coach?
Well, yeah, just recently. This just popped up, I think, on the Twitter. This was, I think, probably from a Spanish source, but David Emmett picked up on this as well, saying that Lorenzo is about to drop Alex Debon as his advisor or rider coach. And I suppose he's only been in that job for about 3 months. So, I mean, Alex Debon is not somebody I'm super familiar with. I sort of remember him from as a sort of old Moto2 rider. And I think we were talking about this before, not the type of person I'd necessarily tap to advise a world champion on riding a modern-day MotoGP bike. But who's to say? But clearly that's something that's not working for him, and he feels like he needs to make some change there. We'll have to see how that unfolds, if there's more sort of reasoning or rationale comes out behind that.
It's something that certainly needs to change for him. Something clearly isn't working, and I think I maybe in the smallest club in the world of the Jorge Lorenzo fan club, i.e. myself and Martin Darlington, I tend to get heckled quite regularly from both my girlfriend Jennifer and from my daughter Emily, who are taking great delight in the fact that he's not doing the way he should be. And I just hope that soon that it gets turned around, and then I can stick the metaphorical, there we go, there we are, the metaphorical two fingers up to them both.
You know, I watch him and you just sometimes feel like he's just having all this bad luck. It just, you know, it's sometimes almost painful for watch. I know some people probably sit there sort of watching it with delightful glee, but I do generally find, you know, I want to see him do well, maybe not quite as well as Dovizioso right now, but I want to see him there kind of and there, thereabouts, you know. But
at least further towards the front and battling with the guys at the front.
Because he has had some real flashes of real pace. So I think he just needs one sort of really, really good event.
He's definitely a confidence man, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And I mean, that was one thing, obviously, that was missing. They were missing the aero. And with that, that may well come back at the next round. Was it next Argentina?
Argentina, yeah.
So, you know, that might come back, and therefore he'll get the front end feel back again, and that might sort of give him the confidence again that he needs. But I think this sort of goes for all the top bikes now. They are so close, they are so competitive, that it seems to really come down to just sort of this minutiae of tyre management and how the bikes are using the tyres at different stages during the race.
Sure. Did I read that it was the closest overall finish in quite a number of seasons?
It wouldn't surprise me if it was. It was incredibly tight. I mean, even just looking at qualifying too, I mean, they had the first top 12 covered by a second or something crazy like that. I mean, it was incredibly tight in qualifying.
Yeah, and then I'm sure the race overall was the closest margin between the race winner and the final finisher for a number of years.
Yeah.
So they're clearly doing something right. The changes,
yeah.
They again, as we've seen in World Superbikes that we'll come to shortly, the changes don't happen overnight. And these changes in MotoGP have taken almost five seasons to come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And now, we, as fans, we're reaping the rewards. As riders, it's particularly frustrating, I'm sure. But hey, it's your job. Deal with it.
Well, I don't know. I think sometimes, I mean, this will go back to some of the World Superbike riders. I think they're racers. You know, they're not riders, they're racers. It's not about individually going out on your own and just trying to go as fast as possible. It's all that sort of slicing and dicing and stuffing up the other guy and, you know, outthinking him as well as outracing him.
Yeah.
And I think that's the fun stuff. So I think, you know, watching all these riders being able to get in the mix and recognize that now they're so tight, it can be one of these things where it's, you know, this circuit will give them an advantage or it'll slightly favor them, or, you know, someone's just having a little bit of an off day. And I think as we saw too with Zarco, you know, he, in his mind, felt that he got a below par quality tire.
Yes.
I mean, he was literally kind of calling his fade a mechanical from the standpoint that this is now down to this, you know, tiny quality control issues that you're getting with the Michelin tires. So all of these little things now, you know, where they were probably didn't have a huge bearing in years gone past, now they're really starting to play a part in shaping a weekend. And I think it's great.
We're actually getting back to cut and thrust racing rather than a couple of laps of position ordering. And then sitting back and wait, well, unless he breaks down or crashes, that's going to be the result. But now the cut and thrust, and which we saw last season as well with Dovi and Marc Marquez, who Dovi winning 3-0 on last corner duff-ups is doing really well. And that's really bringing the fans back into it as well and really piquing interest. And as we've seen from World Superbikes this weekend and hopefully, and what we saw with British Superbikes last year, the three major race series are all heading into what could be the best season ever.
Well, let's talk about World Superbikes, because I was basically expecting to sit down with you and sort of go, OK, so World Superbikes, Johnny Ray does a double. OK, now British Superbikes. You know, that's what I was expecting to have the conversation. So Friday, you know, I had a little kind of peek at, think, of free practice one. And when I looked, it was Javier Forres was like number one. Johnny Ray was sort of down in six or whatever. You know, you're like, hang on a minute, this is not, you know, usual form, because pretty much Kawasaki have just had the run of the roost at Thailand in previous years.
Sure they have. It really is the Jonathan Ray circuit of Thailand. One thing that has become apparent this weekend is what Kawasaki are doing to make up for what they've had taken away became very, very evident across the two races, as we'll come to once we discuss each race on its own merit. But the rules that they're changing and the rev limits, and it is, maybe it's not quite fair to Kawasaki. They're being punished for being successful. Why, I understand that. But as a spectacle and a business and from a revenue perspective for the series owners, it's pretty detrimental. And when you look at MotoGP, if you have somebody running off in the distance every weekend, it's not the most exciting of championships, and it's all about, it is bums on seat, it is eyes on the TV, it is feet through the gate. It is an entertainment industry. As much as we try and get away from the actual essence of the sport, the purity of prototype racing from MotoGP will not change. From World Superbikes, the guys with the most money will always be the fastest, and that's what the rules are trying to change. Because there are only two major manufacturers in there, because Aprilia, God bless Sean Muir and the guys from Gisbra, they're not making that step to where they need to be. I think there's a semi-factory BMW effort. But if you're not on green or you're not on red, the point, you're not quite going to be in that top three. However, as we had the conversation about previously, on Saturday morning about Yamaha, they've had a real big input from Japan this weekend. And although that didn't come quite to the fore in race one, certainly by race two, there was something markedly different about the pace of the two Yamahas. So if we can add blue to the green and the red, then we are going to make the races more interesting. And the extra red of Xavi Forres as well, who was outstanding. And the final piece to the jigsaw, Honda.
Well, and this is my hope. This is the first year of really a big regulation change, which we've seen and we'll talk about, has really sort of compressed up the field and stopped Kawasaki marching away. I mean, you're right. I mean, anybody who spends the most money, which Kawasaki do, it's their primary motor racing form for them. So this is where a majority of their budget goes. But closing it up, my hope is that it will encourage other manufacturers, even if it's not a full world factory effort, maybe it's the European, elements of different companies coming in. There's a one BMW, which is just bizarre to see. There's no Suzuki's on the grid.
No.
Baz is running the only BMW. I'm not even sure if it's semi-factory. I'm sure he was running into certainly Australia, saying that they're pretty much on the standard BMW race electronics and ECU. So they hadn't really gone to any sort of sophisticated. Exactly. My hope, too, is I think that BMW are going to be releasing a new 1000RR in about 2019. So that could be even the end of this year. That may come, therefore, with a new sort of push from them to do 1 or 2 years of motorsport. You know, German IDM doesn't exist anymore. So, World Superbike seems a logical place. If you're going to launch a sports bike to give it some kudos, I think it should be racing.
Of course, without question. They did that with the Panigale R. They're going to do it with the V4 when it comes out. They pushed the Yamaha R1 when that was relaunched. So, and the ZX10 RR as well. All the major manufacturers have done that. So the BMW needs to be up there on a pedestal with the rest of them and go, right, we have the best riders that we can lay our hands on. We have the best technicians we can lay our hands on. We have the best kit that we can lay our hands on. Let's go and take it to the boys in World Superbikes and let's get back to those days of various manufacturers running in the top six, which we are now. So we're getting towards that point, should I say. With the manufacturers I said previously, but if we can bring BMW into that, and if we can let Aprilia step up their game and hopefully take that little step forward that they clearly need to take, that extra half a second or 0.3, just to take them a little bit closer to the podium each weekend, that's what we need. And again, that will then in turn bring the viewers back to World Superbikes. It will bring spectators back to World Superbikes. And it's all the same principle that Stuart Higgs has applied to British Superbikes.
And there's one other manufacturer I'm kind of secretly hoping will come back as well, and that's KTM. KTM now, obviously, with a V4 MotoGP bike, I would love to see some sort of, they had an RC8 as a sort of a sporting road bike. I would love to see some sort of MotoGP inspired or derived V4000 with white power suspension and, them launching that, which then comes and competes and brings them into World Superbike as well. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely. This is the more the merrier, isn't it?
And obviously Honda keep promising a new Fireblade. So, it is there. And I don't know if we know the 600s are going away. Factories, when they're talking about sports bikes now, it really only leaves 1000cc bikes for them to develop and to focus on. So, yeah, like I say, I'm hoping that, we have a really good year, that this sort of proves that the rule tweaks have done what they need. But it was hard. I don't know about you, maybe, like I say, for most casual fans, they probably don't even think about it, but I am sat there watching, like I say, those early free practices where Johnny Ray was sort of down in six and stuff, and there's just this sense that, he's being constrained. It's like he's dragging a great big pile of bricks behind him, or they've kind of, come and lumped his bike with a huge great, pile of coal or something to slow him down, to drag him around, because he really did feel like you're starting to see he's having to work now. He's really, really having to maybe the bike was doing a lot more, but now it's just down to his sheer skill and, just 100% effort to get that thing to go so fast.
Which, for them watching public, is fantastic.
Yeah. As it is, you want to see them work. You want to see them in the Parc Fermé, sort of sweating
really
and puffing. And
Johnny Ray knobbing off into the distance by 3 or 4 seconds. Yes, he is the class. Yes, he is being penalised for his success. Yes, Kawasaki are being penalised for their success. I completely understand why Dorna are doing what they're doing, why the organisers are doing, why the FIM are doing what they are doing to those teams and those riders. Do I agree with it? not in the greatest sense, because it is penalizing success. But for actually watching the racing from, if you watch from a neutral perspective of motorcycle racing, taken at face value, this is what we should be seeing. Closer races and the cut and thrust, as we said previously, of actual racecraft trying to outsmart one another on the track. To coin a popular phrase, you can only piss with the dick that you've got. So that's what you've got to ride. So go and ride it, regardless of the politics and the whys and the wherefores. Stripping it back to the bare values, that's what you've got to ride. Go and ride it. We didn't hear many people complaining in British Superbikes when they took away the rider aids. And look at the racing that it's made there.
And I think it's allowing some of the riders to shine. So, I mean, we can talk about this now from the qualifying. But, you know, like in the overall qualifying, Javi Forres, you know, comprehensively out-qualified both of the factory Ducatis. He finished up in fifth. Melandri is back in seventh with Chaz back in ninth. I mean, that's a pretty impressive showing for a non-factory rider.
Absolutely it is. And he was one of the outstanding stars of the weekend, along with Leon Camier as well. It's that's a bit of a smack in the arm for the factory guys, that the satellite bike can actually match them and even beat them for pace, both in qualifying and in the races. So looking at the qualifying times, I mean, I was at work on Saturday, so obviously with a massive wink, I didn't see qualifying.
Of course you didn't.
Nah, it's there's ways and means. It was quite possibly the best last 3 minutes of qualifying I've seen in quite a while. On the last laps, and the last minute and a half, red helmets all the way down the timing tower on the left-hand side. And you didn't know until the flag actually dropped and the last rider crossed the line. It was up in the air as to who was going to take pole. Tom Sykes banging in a pole record lap to basically what we thought was take pole position before Johnny Ray pips him by 0.003 of a second. But the standout man for qualifying for me was Leon Camier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'd been sort of fairly consistently fast, but that was still a blinding time. He was only about a tenth of a second behind Sykes there in third.
Yeah.
And actually, Jordi Torres as well on the MV in fourth. I mean, he was only another tenth behind Camier as well. And, you know, that's another bike too, where it's sort of difficult to gauge how much development or active development is going on from Augusta's standpoint.
It is. And that was another standout. We keep picking them out as we go down the...
They're all standouts.
Yeah. They're all world-level riders, aren't they? So they're all standout riders in their own merit. But to see Jordi Torres up there on the MV, which Leon Camier obviously campaigned last year, with varying degrees of results, the MV, it looks pretty strong this year, I have to say. And to finish ahead of the Ducatis as well was something a little bit special. Alex Lowe's in sixth, not so bad. For the Yamaha perspective, you expect them to be top six, really. Melandri in seventh, it's a bit of a you raise the eyebrow on that one. Eugene Laverty in eighth, kind of to be expected. But Chaz Davis in ninth, no. We weren't quite expecting to be, but only then 0.3 off the pace.
Well, this is it. I mean, like the top, 11 separated by, you know, 0.6 of a second.
Yeah, which works fantastically for the qualifying. And it was the usual suspects that were in there, just not quite in the order outside of the top two that you would anticipate. You know, Loris Baz coming back from MotoGP in 15th, Yoni Hernandez in 18th. There's some big names that are outside of the top 10. And the lone, not the lone American, but there are two. The second of the Americans, Jake Gagne, showing really well in qualifying, despite his little spill.
Yeah, he did go down in qualifying one, that's right. But, I mean, he had some fairly good pace as well. I think it was Toprak and Salvatore who were in Q1 who ultimately went through then into Q2.
Yeah.
I mean, Toprak as well, another consistent, good qualifying as well, pretty solid, because this is a track he's not ridden at before, so he was probably still learning his way around.
Good for a rookie.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I was just trying to think, so we were talking about Camier as well. I think before we came on air, we were just touching on the fact that we know that they're sort of a considering an electronic exchange. They were out in Spain at Monte Blanco testing the
Magneti Marelli.
Thank you. Magneti Marelli electronic setup. It sounds like when they came here, they decided to stick with what they know, which was the Cosworth electronics. And I found that a curious decision. I mean, I get the standpoint that it's kind of the better the devil you know, and they were aim potentially to get a good result from that. But if you're considering changing, this seemed like a perfect testing opportunity. Maybe you don't get the result, the best result that you can, but the data and the information that you would get, because they're going back to Aragon, and if I understand it, they have to make a decision as to which electronics they're going to run from Aragon onwards, and that will be it for the season. So this felt like a testing opportunity missed.
Potentially so. But after the displays so far, Leon said on the TV that they know that they're going to have to take a step backwards to take the step forwards. And they figured out they had the opportunity on the flyaways to continue with the Cosworth electronics for this round, bank the points that they projected that they could get with the form that Leon's been showing on the Honda Fireblade, but then go to Aragon. I can't remember if he said that they've already tested at Assen or they have got a big test at Assen coming up before the Assen round, and that being Tenkate Honda's local circuit. They will, I don't doubt that they will switch to the Magneti Marelli kit. It's just a case of when and which is the least damage, because Aragon and Assen, are they back-to-back races? Or is there a gap between the two?
Do you think they might do a test?
They are back-to-back races.
Back-to-back, yeah.
So there isn't a lot of time between the two to make that change. So maybe if they do Aragon with the Cosworth and then switch to Magneti Marelli for Assen, with a big test at Assen prior to that round, which I don't, maybe they can do, they can't do it 7 days before the meeting, potentially, if they operate a similar rule system to British Superbikes. I think they would still run, after the showing that he's made at Buriram, keep the Cosworth electronics for Aragon and then switch to Assen where they've managed to test. That would be my take on it. I've been wrong multiple times before, as listeners will know. So, but that just seems to be the safest option. Run with what they've got at Aragon, test at Assen before then, and then go to Assen with the new electronics.
And it'd be interesting too, because you know, you look at that qualifying, he's like 0.1 behind Johnny Ray. You do tend to think like, well, you know, if it ain't broke, why fix it? You know, why not just stick with that? But clearly that this is going to be offering them something in the future, I assume, that, you know, allows them to tune or expand. And oftentimes I know, you know, they can probably look in the pipeline and say, well, look, you know, there's no sort of mechanical bits coming. So the only room that we've got to tweak and improve this bike is in the electronics.
Certainly.
So this is, you know, this is the only headroom that we've got. So this is why we have to make the change.
Yeah. And Marelli will give them that without a shadow of a doubt. So how long it will take them to return to being 0.1 behind Jonathan Ray? Who knows? But they've certainly got a structure in place. And Chris Pike, who's taken over the overall running of the Honda World Superbike effort, Chris is no mug. He knows exactly what needs to be done. He knows exactly what structure to put in place to make the Honda the best chance of having that gap differ, but for the shortest period of time.
So, well, let's talk about race one then. I mean, it was hot, 32 degrees. Track temperature, I don't know what the humidity was, but you can imagine in Thailand it was going to be pretty hard. But the race, I mean, it was an exciting race from the standpoint that everyone's close, but it was a fairly sort of standard formula race. What did you think?
Once Johnny got away at the front with Tom, and you thought, yeah, well, here we go, this is what it's going to be about, it's the standard Kawasaki Buriram marriage. Leon Cameo, I don't think they were quite banking on Leon Cameo joining the party quite so soon and mixing things up a little bit between them, which was good to see. Obviously, once Johnny got the bit between his teeth, he was pretty much unchallenged and really managed the gap as Xavi Fares joined in the party as well. But it was Xavi Fares and Leon Camier that had a great battle on the breaks, trying to outwit each other. But unfortunately, that brought Chaz Davis a little bit closer to them. Break issues saw Tom Sykes disappear back through the pack a little bit. And one thing that was blindingly obvious watching the races, there's no high-speed stability in Marco Melandri's Panigale R, is there?
That was as sketchy as, oh my God. I mean, I think certainly on some of the straights there were some bumps and it would just set off this oscillation in his bike. And I'm convinced there was a few places where he had to roll off.
Without a shadow of a doubt, yeah. The only way that he could bring it under control is trying to do that on that back straight turn two into turn three, because turn two is literally just a kink, isn't it?
Yeah.
But into turn three, to actually roll off to stabilise the bikes before you jump on the brakes, that's just going to kick the shit out of your lap times. It's things that he's doing that he shouldn't have to do. When you look at the stability of a Kawasaki going into turn three, of the Honda, of Xavi Fares' Ducati, was as stable as you like.
And I didn't see it from Chaz's.
No, Chaz also.
It was definitely. No. I mean, I know Melandri, he's what, like 5'5" and fairly light. And they, you know, they were conscious it was a problem. They were fiddling. And I know for race two, they were trying to, a few different solutions, but they couldn't seem to get on top with it. But you'd see the back start to fishtail and it would just get worse and worse. And it would just kind of propagate through the bike until the front wheel was wobbling too.
Yeah.
And was really, really alarming. And I'm, like I say, I'm sure there was a few times where he just had to back off the throttle because there were people would come up to pass him and they would just get past him on the acceleration or in different places. So that for sure was a real problem. And I think that really, really hampered his overall speed, no question.
One thing that came up from the Kawasaki over the weekend was they were discussing the fact on the TV that, yes, they've been capped on their rev limit, so they're having to look in other places to try and make up that deficit that the rev limit incorporates. And one of the main places they're looking to do it is on braking. And it's no coincidence that in race one, Tom Sykes had issues with his brakes, and in race two, as we'll come to, Jonathan Rea had issues with his brakes as well. Now, there are certain electronic maps that they have in place to allow Johnny to get away, to do what he needs to do on the opening lap, certainly in race two, to progress through the field. But for whatever reason, they're putting an awful lot of emphasis on the brakes. And at Buriram, it showed up that is a fragile theory for them to take forward. Yes, there was an awful lot of heat in Buriram. Yes, it makes a very big difference to the brakes and whether they have brake fade or the issues that they have, brakes overheating, because I don't know if they can run with the cooling ducts, because there's no cool air to cool the brakes, to cool the discs and the pads. So that was something that hindered Tom Sykes, certainly in race one. But Johnny being out in the front, maybe slightly cooler conditions, didn't really have that issue because he didn't have to fight. So he wasn't quite as aggressive. And Johnny is a really, really intelligent rider. So he could manage the gap as much as he needed to without overstressing the brakes. But Davis and Camier, their braking battle was fantastic. Johnny Rea said he was out of the top 10 in all of the speed traps, which shows how much further down on power they are. One thing that was interesting in race one, the battle between the Yamahas, certainly yeah. No love lost between Alex Lowes and Michael van der Mark, but the respect that they show on track is testament to them both as individuals, I think.
Agreed. And the fact that they both race, so in my mind, they're showing that's pretty much the pace of the Yamaha, I think, because it was very much nip and tuck, the both of them, but they very, very clean passes, very, very clean, giving each other space. And, you know, from my standpoint, too, I was just happy to see Alex not overriding the bike, not pushing it too much and risking a fall. I mean, he brought it home in a good, strong fifth place, and that was great to see.
It was, and again, yes, for the third race this year, finishing ahead of Michael van der Mark. So it's something that he's learning step by step, and it's taking its time to change Alex's mindset. I know he works a lot with his trainer, Kurt Gibbons, who also trains Leon Haslam and Ty Woffenden, and one or two other, a couple of boxers as well, Dave Ryan, Sandy Ryan, his sister. So they focus a lot on the mental side of the racing and how to approach it. And that's something that's starting really to show through with Alex. And he's really maturing as a rider. Yes, he's got a tag as a crasher, as has Sam. Sam struggles to shake off that tag for obvious reasons because he keeps crashing. But for Alex, yeah, he's building. And with the sensation that surrounds Michael van der Mark as a Suzuka 8-hour winner, and he is the next big thing, and he's really holding his own in that team. And it's great to see from a British perspective, absolutely. Michael van der Mark's a fantastic rider. Tom Sykes, he dropped off to sixth place, but he was 7.5 seconds off his teammate, which overall we know he isn't in the bigger picture.
That was definitely brake problems. I mean, he said he had the fade. He started cranking the adjuster up. I mean, he had it pretty much coming back to the bar. You know, that's still a good points finish, even with a technical fault like that.
Yeah, which worked great. So it was Johnny Ray that took the top spot ahead of Chavi Forres, which is a great race for him on the satellite Panigale R. And Chaz Davis making a late lunge after a battle with his big mate Leon Camier. Disappointed not to see Leon on the podium after the efforts he'd put in. But, you know, a fourth place, if you'd have offered them that at the start of the season, they'd have been, yeah, thanks, we'll take that.
And it was impressive to see how long Leon was able to hold off Chaz. I mean, Leon was a demon on the break. Chaz kept trying to line up moves to the inside, but Leon was always just that little fraction later on the breaks. And Chaz, I think, too, as well, obviously, you know, was respecting Leon, a good mate. I know they're neighbours, so they live close by. So, you know, Chaz was looking for that nice, clean pass, and he was able to do it with sort of one or two laps remaining.
Yeah, certainly the Honda wasn't a rolling roadblock. It was there on merit, most definitely.
So from that standpoint, then we had the, I always have to work this out. So the starting grid there for race two is that meant that Camier was then on pole.
Yep.
Alongside Lowe's and Tom on the front row, we had van der Mark, Melandri and Laverty on the second row, and Chaz, Javi Forres in eighth, and Johnny Ray on the third row. So obviously Johnny was looking for another good start, and his typical aggressive try and get the moves in early to get to the front. With this being so tight and he hasn't got the power to just pull away, he had to be fairly aggressive right from the get-go. And going back to your point that you were talking about earlier too, how Johnny's had to sort of change his style somewhat to ride the Kawasaki fast. He was talking about, I think, having to carry a lot more corner speed, you know, almost thinking of the bike as more of a super sport bike, like a 600.
Yeah.
And just trying to carry the corner speed in. And I think, you know, this may also go back to your point too, because you're right that Johnny had, he then had brake problems in the second race. And with him having to do those sort of aggressive moves and not having that sort of little power advantage, he was therefore having presumably to get people on the brakes, was having to push the braking a little bit harder. And we saw this in race two, that he started to have brake problems as well. It was interesting that the commentary was saying like, and Johnny Ray runs wide again, another mistake. And you could see quite clearly someone at his level doesn't make those kind of mistakes. He was having a technical issue, and yeah, the logic was it was going to be the brakes.
I'd love to know what the Kawasaki plan was for race two. I don't think I've ever seen Jonathan Ray so aggressive on an opening lap. The passes he was making, he was coming from so far back, running in deep on the brakes, running the corner speed, and sitting riders up left, right, and center. It was, I mean, he put a tough pass on Laverty, he put a tough pass on Leon Camier, put a tough pass on Melandri, but he was also making a passage, running deep, and they were cutting back underneath him. So he looked out of sorts on that opening lap of race two. And it was something that he looked real urgent to get to the front. Not that he was panicking so much, but the plan was get to the front as soon as possible. And he was trying to make that at all costs. He admitted before the start of race two that they had a system in place that would see him at least dispatch the second row before he gets to turn one. So they have something that they work on with their electronics that will, the Kawasaki launches really well anyway, but they have maps in place for that, reading into that, that he will use on the opening couple of laps to give him the impetus that he needs to get past. But the braking, whether he cooked his brakes early, whether it just in the dirty air, he didn't have that clean air that he had in race one to be able to do what he needed to do. And he also lost brake feel, I think, fairly early on. And that, when he crossed the line, that just as he showed the onboard picture, as soon as he crossed the line, the first thing he reached for was his brake adjuster. And it was just something I picked up on at the end of the race.
Yeah, he said the same, that it just, you know, normally he will break one or two fingers, but it was coming back to the bar so much. He had to pull his fingers out of the way, use all the fingers on the brake lever, had the adjuster whammed up to the max. And I think there was one move as well later in the race he made on Melandri, and he spoke about the fact that, yeah, you know, actually maybe I shouldn't have done that, you know, that he, you know, lined him up and he was thinking like, you know what, I'm not sure if I have the confidence in the brakes, I'm going to reach for the handle, pull, and I'm not sure what I'm going to get. Because he was saying that, you know, sometimes there would be an inconsistency, that, you know, he would actually get some you know, some grip, some brake, and other times it would literally come back. So we saw that a few times, him sort of running in deep and running out wide. Occasionally he, you know, would still be able to turn it and get back to keep the corner, but I think there were one or two passes where you just see he just went a bit too wide.
Yeah, and he just didn't have the brake feel to be able to pull it back or to have to actually make that move in the first place. Positive to see the Yamahas out front early doors. That was something really good. And again, as we said previously about the respect between the two guys, but they won't give each other an inch, passing backwards and forwards and having a good battle between them. Two very contrasting styles between Alex Lowes and Michael van der Mark. The low, slightly more aggressive style. Magic Mike is a little bit more traditional, very smooth, very flowing with his riding style. And it's interesting to see the dynamic between the two of them on and actually being able to race out front together before they were chased down by Chaz Davies. It was, and obviously Leon Cameron was in the mix to a point before he faded back a little bit to sixth place, then it did become a little bit of a processional race from there.
But I thought Alex was very mature as well. He had pushed, I mean, they both of them pushed past Kamiya to take the lead, and then Lowes was following van der Mark. And, you know, he had a few looks, and then he got past and led for a little bit. But then van der Mark came past and he seemed to just let that go. He recognized that van der Mark had the pace, that, you know, Lowes just seemed to settle in and go with him for the earlier stages with the idea, I think, of seeing like, OK, you know, let's see from like halfway, you know, what kind of pace he's got, and, you know, plan his sort of his strategy from that standpoint. I mean, the other thing too, talking about the car, you know, the Johnny Ray had problems. Tom Sykes, you know, there he was on the front row as well, but he just gently went backwards and ultimately pulled into the pits and retired. Talking about a front fork issue, something had broken there. So clearly early on realized he didn't have the feel, and, you know, presumably was feeling like this just wasn't, this was dangerous and he needed to pull in. So it's interesting to see, you know, Kawasaki normally, who have been so good, so dependable, it's hard for me to even think about any mechanical issues they've had, you know, last season, both bikes afflicted with technical issues.
And this is, for me, the direct result of the RPM limit. They're having to stress the bike in other areas to try and make up the deficit that's been incurred by the RPM limit. And I mean, I watched the Eurosport coverage over the weekend, this morning, before we came on the show. Shane Byrne, Gino Rea, and Matt Roberts have been fantastic on the coverage. Charlie Hiscott, a massive doff of the cap to Charlie for his line of questioning this weekend. He is outstanding. I know we've said previously, and we said before the show, sometimes the questioning of not particularly of riders, because it's unfair sometimes to hit the riders that hard, and they end up like rabbits in a headlight. But to question the likes of Perry Reber and Chris Pike and the guys on the technical side, Charlie absolutely nailed them three or four times over the weekend with his questioning. And I'd love to see that more often. Charlie's fantastic with his line of questioning, and he's not scared to get in there. He clearly knew that there was an issue with the front forks on Tom Sykes's bike, and he just came out with it to Tom Sykes's crew chief. Right, what's the problem with the front forks? Why did they break? What happened? Was it the, you know, why did they break? Was it an internal issue? Was it an external issue? What happened? And he did the same with Andrea Dasoli with the electronics on the Yamaha. You know, why are they, what doing it? What's going on? Why are you doing this? And they when they breathe three or four times before they answer the question, you know they're already on the ropes. So kudos to Charlie Hiscott for that, for this weekend. But something that that Shane Byrne picked up on the Eurosport coverage, he said maybe, he said he was trying to work out how the shower forks work, whether they were air forks or whether they were oil forks. Now his take on it was potentially that Tom had bottomed out the forks and maybe popped a seal, which could be a very feasible issue. The coverage that those guys gave was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, maybe that there was a problem with the seal at the bottom. Maybe they had been bottomed out too far again, which is aggressive braking, which fits in with the Kawasaki mantra at the moment of trying to find those extra couple of tenths under the braking. I don't know, I may be talking out of turn, I don't, but hopefully somebody listening will be able to correct us on that, or maybe point us in the right direction. But to see the issues that Kawasaki are having, yeah, we know exactly where they're coming from, and hopefully they can be addressed somewhat by Aragon. I mean, it's not as if there's any heavy braking areas at Aragon, is there? Oh Jesus.
Oh, yeah, there are. I've been lucky enough to do quite a number of track days.
Exactly.
At Aragon. It's a fantastic circuit, but yeah, there's definitely a few places where you're hauling on the anchors. Having said that, I mean, I wouldn't expect the overall air temperature to be as bad. And you can imagine right now that someone in the Showa factory is getting a good ass kicking.
Sure.
So, you know, hopefully they'll have some of that solved as well. But it is good to see that Eurosport's providing that technical coverage. I watched through the Dorna video pass, which is good visually, but I wouldn't say the analysis is up to that kind of quality. So you do lack that sort of quick feedback as to what's going on, what are the issues, and what's happening.
And nobody can see those issues better than a current rider, a current superbike rider of the level of Shane Byrne, and certainly of Gino Ria, who is obviously, he's cut his teeth on the smaller bikes and is now stepping up to his first season on a big bike. But with nobody can see those things better than a rider can, and which is why we were said back previously about Matt Roberts being a presenter. Mm-hmm. He's not there for his in-depth knowledge, and the same with Steve English on the Dorna coverage. Steve, fantastic journalist, really knows the riders, really knows his racing, but isn't a racer, and that's the one side that the Dorna coverage misses. Is the rider input. Harry was fantastic on there last year. I've not had the fortune of listening to the new guy this season. Mixed reports from him, but Steve English, certainly he knows which side his bread's buttered as far as racing goes, and he will give you the insight that he can, but it's not a racer's insight, and that's the one thing the Dorna coverage misses.
Yeah, and I think too, the Dorna pit lane reporters are not going to be asking those pointed questions like Charlie is prepared to just get in there and, you know, just sort of ask those awkward questions. Unfortunately, you don't tend to get that from the Dorna people. They're more just tossing fluffball questions to get the nice little sort of press release.
It's a soundbite press release, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a shame. And you're right. Harry used to do a lot of on the ground, in the garages, talking to riders, talking to teams, you know, really pulling a ton of information before heading up into the commentary booth. And you know, all of that technical stuff would then sort of come out during the race. They're not there yet, unfortunately.
No, Steve has that on his own, doesn't he, at the moment?
Yeah. So I might be seeing if I can't hack my way back into Eurosport. So the one thing I did see, and I wanted to comment too, you probably saw it too, was Eugene's crash in that race too. He went down, I think, somewhere in about lap six, between turn six and seven.
He did, yeah.
He went down. I think he'd lost the front, went down. But unfortunately, Torres, who was literally right behind him, had nowhere to go. And although I didn't see it, ran over.
I've not seen it either.
Eugene,
it certainly wasn't on the coverage.
So when they cut back to it, they had Eugene He was on the ground. He'd sort of skidded off into a tarmac runoff area, but clearly in some distress.
He knew there was issues.
Waving there, not able to either get it up or move, and having to wave to pull the marshals over it. So it did sound like a pretty horrendous crash. And any rider getting hit and run over at that speed is a serious, serious condition. There was something, I was thinking, it sounded to me that maybe should have been a red flag.
Yeah, for the position that he was in, he was off the track, but he was clearly physically incapacitated. He wasn't able to get to his own 2 feet of his own accord. So why just putting a couple of bales up and having a couple of spotters looking out saying, guys, somebody's crashing, they're coming towards us, get out of the way. You wouldn't have been able to move Eugene at the same time. So, that should have been really a red flag situation for me because of his position. If he's lost the front there, somebody else could potentially lose the front there. Charlie spoke
for me, it was less, sorry to interrupt,
no, go ahead.
Less about the position, but the fact that he actually been run over by another bike. I think it was one thing if he just crashed and skidded to a halt, but in my mind, it felt like there should be some sort of protocol that, if a rider falls and then is struck by a following bike, that almost certainly is going to be a more serious medical issue. And therefore, it struck me that there should be immediate red flags to make sure that there is no delay in getting attention.
Sure.
To that rider.
We've seen it before in cases where guys have been run over by other bikes, and for better luck, they've got up and gone, yeah, cheers for that. Mm. That hurt. So, there is a call for that. It doesn't happen every time, but obviously we've very sad circumstances in the past, more recently in BSB last season, Mark Fincham at Thruxton, unfortunately, was a similar scenario. And we go back, obviously, to Marco Simoncelli. Mm-hmm. It isn't always the case that somebody's injured but hit by the bike. But yes, there should be some kind of protocol in place. Sean Muir gave an interview with Charlie shortly after the end of race two. Basically, on the outlap, on the sighting lap, they'd had the Pirelli front was, according to Eugene and according to Sean Muir, was out of round. So he was fighting chatter right from the start of the race. And Sean basically pointed the finger saying, that was potentially the cause of what happened. He'd been fighting it. He'd lost the front in a place where it wasn't usual for guys to lose the front. So he clearly pointed the finger at the Pirelli front on that one. So it was almost expected, but obviously not the result of the crash was what was expected. So we wish Eugene Laverty all the very best. He's an inferior and superior public ramus fracture, but the pelvis is stable. So he's in a hospital now. I did see there was a tweet from him came out earlier on, just before we came on air. Where he, as I'm desperately looking through my Twitter feed to see what he's come out with. It won't keep him away for long. He had a successful operation last night in Buriram for some internal damage. So he said he's on the road to recovery.
Yeah, and I think there was almost intimating that he's hoping to be fit enough to ride Aragon.
Wow.
Yeah. Salvatore was riding, I know, only having come back from a broken collarbone. These riders do bounce back incredibly quickly. I mean, a broken pelvis does sound something more serious.
It does a little bit, especially for a motorcycle racer.
Yeah, but do genuinely wish him all the best. There was a few moments there. It was pretty horrible to watch. I was keeping tabs on Twitter. So thank God that exists to be able to sort of get quick updates and everything.
Because, he has 3 weeks to recover.
Yeah. Well, all the very, very best to Eugene, friends and family. Hope it's a full and fast recovery.
Absolutely.
So getting back to the race, we kind of left it with the Yamahas out front, and then Chaz just seemed to do pretty much what he had done in race one. He just remorselessly came forward, and just picked them off one by one until he pushed his way to the front. And then he was able to pull, you know, a bit of a gap there. So we had Chaz crossing the line in first place, taking his first victory in Thailand. First time for a Ducati, I think.
Yeah.
And also his first victory of this season as well, to get his title chances starting on the right foot. Michael Vandermark came in second. Alex, really, really good, solid third. It was really good to see actually both of the Yamahas up on the podium. You know, they've been promising so much and trying so hard last year. So, you know, this was a real positive thing and something that it was great to see the team be rewarded with all their hard work as well. And, you know, if this was the Japanese Superbike Electronics helping pay off, then great. I mean, this promises better things as well for Aragon.
Absolutely. Whatever helps.
So Johnny Ray limped home, if you can call it that, in fourth, with Javier Forrest in five. Kamiya was able to bring still a pretty strong six. I mean, I know he was sort of 10 seconds or so behind the leader, and Melandri brought his bucking Bronco home in seventh.
Yeah, Toprak in eighth. That's a good return for the rookie. That's a great result for him. That'll give him the confidence that he needs. Salvadori in ninth, PJ Jacobson in 10th. Excuse me. Then Yoni Hernandez, Loris Baz, Jake Gagne taking a point, taking 2 points, in fact, finishing 14th. One thing that Chaz Davis, he really was the most patient man of the weekend, wasn't he? Didn't get the greatest to qualify and picked his way through in race one and again was patient in race two. Very, very mature ride from the Welshman. Very impressive to see that. Leon Kamier, he had slight issues with his Red Bull Honda CBR 1000RR Fireblade for its full title. He was quizzed on the TV, but he was such a political answer. He answered the question without even answering when Charlie asked him what the problems were. So he wasn't giving anything away whatsoever. Very, very intelligent rider, very intelligent man. And my girlfriend's second favorite male after me.
that's something, because he's quite cute.
Yeah, which makes me wonder how do I fit into all this with World Superbike's own version of Christian Grey, and there's Dave over here like, hiya. so now I'm very fortunate to be ahead of Leon Kamiya. We'll see how that changes when we end up at World Superbikes at Donington. We'll see if I get dumped prior to going to the TT, but no, it's fine. I'll happily come second to Leon Kamiya should that ever be the case. Yeah, he's a good looking lad, very intelligent, and yeah, for me, rider of the weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very, very strongly fought. I mean, think of race one, how hard he felt to hold off Chaz, and another good strong ride in race two. I mean, you look at Gagne back in 14th. I don't know if he was suffering from particular issues as well, but you know, definitely shows you that Kamiya is able to extract every ounce of performance out of that Honda. I really do hope that it's not too big and too longer step back as they change if they do decide to change the electronics on that, because I would still love to see him up there fighting in the future rounds.
Completely. Yeah, Jake Gagne, he's a rookie to the class. Every track he goes to is pretty much a new track for him. So he's learning step by step. We'll be hopefully catching up with Mick Shanley when we go to Donington in May. So he'll give us a lowdown on what Jake's doing. He's Jake's crew chief for the season. Obviously, we said Chris Pike overlooking the whole of the team. So there's a good British influence in the Honda World Superbike team, along with Leon Kamiya. So they could be the dark horses for the season to put in the strong results towards the end of the year. But as we said about the manufacturers, we have Yamaha up there. We have Ducati up there. We have the Kawasaki's up there. So, it's been a good start to the season for the much maligned World Superbike Championship, I think.
And it was entertaining racing.
Yeah.
Genuinely.
That's got to be number one, hasn't it?
Yeah, race two was, you know, really entertaining racing. It was difficult to, you know, good, fast, hard, strong moves, you know, clean overtaking, and really not a strong sense of who was, you know, going to take it. I mean, Chaz took the win, but he took that with no real performance advantage, just sort of hard graft.
Yeah.
Taking each place one by one by one.
And if hard graft is the name of the game for motorcycle racing these days across the three main championships, I'm all for it. I want to see close racing. I want to see cut and thrust. I want to see racecraft. I want to see somebody trying to outwit somebody else. It's almost, you know, you don't have that in, it's similar to what you have in Speedway. You know, the performance levels are reasonable on a par, and it's down to rider, it's down to racecraft. It's down to changing your lines. It's down to changing your approach, changing your braking markers, maybe taking that corner a little bit different. And again, it trying to outwit each other. Yeah, there's the performance advantages. Yes, you know, racing is racing, and it's the best rider on the best bike at the end of the day who will ultimately come out on top. But it's how he gets there. I can't stress this enough. It's the cut and thrust of racing, like the old 250 days and the old 125 days, and Moto 3 to a point of how that's panning out. That's the racing for me. As much as it's great to see a guy go out in front and win by 5 and 6 seconds, and then from second place, and a 2 second gap to third place, the 3 second gap to fourth place, they're the races that nightmares are made of, aren't they?
I think we've seen too many of those.
Yeah.
To be honest, you know, and the other thing too, you got MotoGP, like you say, Moto 2, Moto 3 now, you know, that's really sort of setting the standard, the benchmark for what motorcycle racing looks like.
Yeah. British Superbike doing the same thing with the changing their electronics, the showdown system. It's all there.
Yeah, you come off the back of that, and, you know, previous years you used to sit down and watch World Superbikes, and oftentimes you just turn off after 5 minutes and sort of go find out what the result was the next day.
Yeah.
But, this year's shaping up to be something good. So Johnny Ray walked away still leading the championship. Leading the championship.
Yep.
Malandri in second, Harry Forrest in third, and Chaz Davis in fourth. I mean, it's still early days, everything to play for, but yeah, you got the Kawasaki's, the stack of Ducatis, the two Yamahas, and then sort of everybody else chasing.
Yeah, top four, 12 points, that'll do.
Yeah, it's great. So the next round of World Superbikes, as we probably mentioned, is going to be in Spain at Motorland Aragon, 13th to the 15th of April, which we're looking forward to. But before then, this weekend upcoming will be the first round of British Superbikes. Now, you were at the first official test last week?
Yes,
which is
Tuesday.
A one-day thing. Now, of course, I saw that it was like, the last official test, and I was sort of sitting down to look at all the... thinking it was going to be like a two-day thing.
No.
And to be honest, it was more of just a fan event, which I thought, you know, that's a really good idea, just to let everyone sort of come down. And I saw some of the pictures, and some of your great pictures.
Thank you.
Too, just like Paddock... Well, actually, those couple of bikes you took in the pit lane were really good.
James Ellison and Jordan Weaving.
Yeah. Now... I'm guessing that the average fan is not allowed into pit lane. You were able to sort of misdirect security and hop under the ropes.
the security and pit lane and pit lane access is an awful lot easier on the test day. Now, it isn't an open pit lane to the public per se, but there aren't the MSV staff patrolling pit lane as there would be on a race day. You still have to have the pit lane etiquette of anytime you walk out of that garage, for God's sake, look right before you do anything. So you need to be reasonably pit lane savvy to be able to wander that side and not draw attention to yourself in the main. Mm-hmm. Yes, that we are lucky in the fact that we know quite a few people across quite a few teams, that we can stand at the front of the garage and you can walk up and down pit lane. There's nobody hauling you back in. We passed Mr. Higgs on the way who... passed his salutations as we did. So he thought, well, okay, if Stuart sees me in pit lane, then we're not going to get kicked out too far. So yeah, I had the GoPro and my little Snapseed app. So yeah, we were lucky enough that we could, you know, get a couple of little photographs in there at the time. But it's on the whole, it's a social event. It's a lot of people catching up with a lot of people they haven't seen since the middle of October. If you're not part of a team and you haven't been out, obviously testing, where the guys were, as we said before, were at Cartagena for the BSB protest, but not every team made it to that round. So some have been at Calafat, some have been at Almeria and Monteblanco, various Guadix. They've really campaigned Spain well through the off-season. This was the first chance for everybody to get together. But a lot of the pre-season media is done on this day. So all the liveries are there. The bikes are wheeled down to the media centre. The riders are in the media center. All the official photographs are done. Impact Images are there. James and Sue from Double Red take all the media shots. Obviously, Eurosport have their, you know, where the riders look up in a dramatic way when the grid lineup comes through on the TV. So, yeah, it's a busy day for the teams and for the riders. There's three sessions three times during the day. So you had BSB and Stock Thau, you had the Supersport and the Stock Six, and you had the Ducatis. And I think the KTMs got out as well. There were no Motorstar present, no BTC riders out on track. But the weather, it was bitterly cold. It was windy. There was next to cockhole track temperature. Nobody was really going to achieve anything other than laps. Although for Leon Haslam, he topped the timing sheets through TSL timing. He was the only guy to get down into the 129s, which on the day that it was cold and there was still snow on the ground from the previous snowfall that we had the weekend before. You know, to get down into the 129s on a cold track, yes, it's a track he knows like the back of his hand, but that bike is looking mint. Leon is looking really lean this year. His body type, he's always looked a little bit on the chunky side previously. He's only, 5'4", maybe 5'5", or something. But he has a very muscular frame. His body type,
so stocky.
It's metamorph or exomorph. Yeah. I can't remember what style it is. But he's working really closely with Brad Howell, a guy who I know really well, on his diet while Kirk trains him well. He's leaned off a lot. He's down, it must be 4 or 5 kgs on his previous racing weight. James Ellison is another one that's leaned off. All the guys seem to really leaned off in the off season. They're all working hard. They're all looking at their diet. They're all looking different. That's where the gains are going to be made in fitness and approach throughout the season. There's going to be literally nothing to show between the top three. I can't see at this point, not doing anybody else a disservice, but you, for your showdown capacity, as we were talking before we came on the show, your guaranteed top three are the top three from last season. That's Shane Byrne, Josh Brooks, Leon Haslam, in championship order, not in prediction order. The fourth, fifth and sixth positions, that's an almighty scrap between potentially, what have we got down here? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 14 riders that could fill those three places. That's where the battle is going to come. That's going to be the interesting watch between now and round 10 in September.
And there's one or two new riders in the mix. I was just looking through the testing time. Gina Rea. Johnny Ray and Gina Rea.
That's it.
he's there on the Suzuki with the Oh My God Racing. he finished fourth in the overall testing, and I'd seen some of the testing times as well. He'd been out in Spain as well, so that's sort of a potential dark horse as well to help mix things up. But yeah, there's a whole selection of people in there, and a lot of people still staying with the same team as last year as well. So there's a lot of consistency, a lot of continuity, a lot of knowledge that's coming across. So a lot of these riders, you know, will likely be quick out of the gate as well, which is going to make the whole thing even more competitive this year.
Yeah, no doubt. The only real changes have been James Ellison and Josh Brooks swapping seats. Ellison dropping into the Anvil tag team and Josh Brooks moving to the factory back to McCam's Yamaha squad. So,
and Laverty, I think, over to Tyco.
Michael going into Tyco alongside Christian Idden is a good move for him. It's a bike that he's really comfortable on. But when you look at the list of names that will fight for those other three places, Dan Linfoot, Jason O'Halloran, Peter Hickman, Glenn Irwin, Michael Laverty, Christian Idden, Luke Mossy, James Ellison, Bradley Ray is in with a chance on the factory Suzuki. Mm-hmm. Jake Dixon, he was there last season. Tommy Bridewell moving back in with Martin Halsall.
Racing.
The place that he has been the most happy in the last number of years, and getting his old supersonic BMW crew back with him as well, who also know how he works, how he operates. He's a unique individual in a lot of ways, and he needs a crew that understand him and what he needs. And added into that as well, as you say, Gino Rea, who could be also be a dark horse. You know, he's not got a lot of big bike experience, but he has a lot of race experience.
Mm-hmm.
Throw the youth in there. We've said Bradley Ray. We've got Mason Law in there. We've got Kyle Ride making his debut, and young Taron McKenzie as well. The fight for top rookie, which will probably be will be between Mason Law, Kyle Ride, Taron McKenzie, and Sylvain Barrier. Now, Sylvain Barrier, pedigree unquestionable. Two-time European Superstock champion, world superbike rider, has the pedigree certainly to challenge. Whether he has the track knowledge to challenge is the next thing. We saw what happened with Davide Giuliano previously at Tyco BMW. He had his big crash going into Graham Hill Bend at Brands Hatch at round two, and we never saw him again. But obviously he did then reappear for Red Bull Honda in various places. He couldn't cut it at BSB. It's that simple. Sylvain Barrier, slightly different approach, in with a good team at Smith's BMW alongside Peter Hickman. He could spring some surprises this year, certainly towards the later rounds, when they get to Brands Hatch, when they get to Silverstone, when they get to Assen. He's going to know those circuits.
Definitely the more what I would call traditional racetracks. I expect him to go a little bit better, but I think you're right. I think a lot of the tracks for British Superbikes are these very tight, very, very unique tracks. And, you know, if you're coming from the big MotoGP, Holgermated type racetracks with tons of runoff and all the rest of it, it's hard to be brave around these tight and twisty places. And someone like that, I imagine you'd at least have to do a full year competing to be competitive a second year. I can't see someone being competitive like that, you know, off the bat. And this is why, you know, the sort of traditional riders that, you know, we have year in, year out, this is where they excel. I think it's less about the performance of the bike. The bikes often are just very much similar. It's that ability to squeeze out a couple of inches of just, you know, track knowledge here and there, those little sort of sneaky passing maneuvers, that little bit just stuffing out the inside, you know, all this sort of inside knowledge that they build up years on years of racing the different series, makes it really difficult for external, you know, foreign people to come in and be competitive quickly. They have to come in, I think, with a mindset that it could be a 2-3 year project to be competitive.
Agreed. And that's where Sylvain Guintoli failed a lot last year, was that he, you know, he ran his better results came from a track that didn't have any trees near it, like Assen.
Yeah.
So it's a track that he knew well. It's a GP homologated track, but he couldn't transfer that ability to Alton Park, to Cadwell Park, to, I mean, Knock Hill, the most tight, nadgery little track on the calendar, is a unique circuit, but it's part of the calendar, so you have to ride it. It's a tough circuit to master. Not so difficult is the Indy circuit at Brands, which is about a similar, it's like an oversized roundabout more than anything, but they're so tied on the number of loud days that they can have at Brands Hatch that they have to run the Indy. If they had their choice, they would run the full circuit, there's no doubt, but it just has to be run on the Indy circuit because there's a housing estate just to the side of where do they come out at the top? At Sheen Bend. West Kingsdown Village is off the side of Sheen Bend as they run down to Clearways. So they can only use that part of the track so many times of the year. And obviously you've got BTC and other events that want to use a full circuit. But certainly I think Sylvain Barrier, he will adjust better than Sylvain Guintoli did. John Hopkins came across. He was fantastic. He adapted superbly well. Josh Brooks adapted when he came, and it is about how quick the guys, and if you think Gino Rea hasn't really, to my knowledge, spent an awful lot of time on UK tracks because he was European stock six runner, if not champion at the same time I think Dan Linfoot was, And a couple of the other French guys, Loris Baz at the time as well, was running in the same championship. And then he went on to Moto2 and World Supersport. So I don't think Gino's got the massive amount of UK track knowledge that a British rider would potentially have. But I think, you know, it's how he adapts to it. I think Taran McKenzie is going to be a real find this year in the same way that... that Bradley Ray was last year. I think the team that Taz has gone into, the McCams Yamaha squad, Grant Bunting's guys, they will see him right for the season. I think he'll outshine his brother, who's on the Moto Rapido Ducati.
That's right. He's standing in for John Hopper, wasn't he? So, because Hopkins, unfortunately, just, you know, has decided to, you know, I don't know if he's officially announced a retirement, but he's definitely taking this year out. My guess is it will probably be in lieu of a retirement. I doubt we'd see him back in British Superbikes. I think he's beat himself up enough. I think he's paid his dues. I think it's time for him to sort of retire and to move on to other things and spend time with his family.
Yeah, we're talking to one of the guys on Tuesday at Donington who witnessed his crash at Brands Hatch, and they said, look, he just didn't even have a chance to hit the brakes. It just, whatever happened. Yeah. Lost the front, and he just hit that wall so hard. Which again, as we go back to Leon Camier, will break Jennifer's heart, because her absolute number one rider is John Hopkins as a racer. So it'll break her heart that if he does retire, he won't be around anymore. But obviously, you know, Leon's doing well, and
I could see John turning up in Moto America. That's sometimes where I think,
thought that's where I thought he would. I figured
might
that's
do
where
another
he'd end up.
Couple
yeah.
of years, and of course, you know, if he was to do that, it's always interesting when you have sort of, you know, riders change series, because it's like a little informal benchmark of, you know, if he was to go there and sort of clean up. Well, you kind of know that Moto America maybe isn't sort of like, you know, quite ready yet to bring some of the top riders across. But, you know, if he goes up there and, you know, is struggling to finish in the top 10, then, you know, that's really encouraging. I think that's
yeah,
really
it's difficult
to
point the level, isn't it? When you remember
it
when
is, yeah.
James Ellison went over there and he rode in what was AMA, which is where he met Sarah, his wife. Chaz Davies rode over in Moto America as well, didn't he, while he was in the wilderness a little bit. And they made good accounts of themselves. Neil Hodgson, another one. They all made good accounts of themselves. But, yeah, it would be nice for them to bring in... obviously, Tony Elias is out there at the moment. He's world-level rider that's gone to Moto America and made a good fist of it. But, yeah, if they could bring a couple more guys in to really find the level where Moto America's at, I'd love to see them back at the glory days of having various nationality riders in the same way that BSB does, and get some more coverage over here so we can watch it. I used to love watching Ben Spies, Matt Maladin, and Nicky Hayden, God bless him, before he departed onto MotoGP. You know, we used to get an awful lot of coverage over here, and Aaron Yates and the guys that were around at the time, but we don't get it now.
Yeah, and Hopkins for me is one of the few riders that is that bridge.
Sure.
You know, he's a known name in sort of Britain and Europe. And obviously, you know, I think he is a known name in the States as well. So he is one of those riders, I think, who could really help promote Moto America. So that's what I thought would happen. I thought, you know, once he gets himself sort of fit and well, he could have a couple of years in Moto America. That would be fantastic. And I don't know if James Ellison is heading that way, because this is his last year in BSB, if that's correct.
It is. This is his last year in BSB before he moves to Texas full time with Sarah and the kids. I don't know. I've sort of tried to find out what his plans are through various people for 2019. It doesn't seem that it's Moto America is where he's going. I think he's just literally moving to the States and making a new life for himself out there, whether it be through physical training, whether it be through fitness, whether it be through as a gym instructor, whatever. But I don't see anything at the moment that says he's going to go to Moto America.
I haven't heard anything either. But, you know, if you're running a team in Moto America and someone of James Ellison's caliber turns up close to home looking for a day job.
And he knows the circuits.
I know it didn't. You know, it doesn't seem again that implausible. But he is someone I think who has had some pretty harsh luck trying to put a constructive season together.
Every year.
I hope
every year
this is the one where finally it all starts to gel. It all starts to come together. Unquestionably, he's on a competitive bike and a great team. And I think, I mean, obviously it's his last year, but I think this is also his best chance.
It is. Now, whether he can make the Anvil Tag Yamaha work as well as Josh Brooks did last year would remain to be seen. They have wildly different riding styles. Josh is very, very different to a lot of riders in the paddock with his setup, how he rides, his OCD, if you like, of how everything should be. There were many, many issues that he had last year that he could ride around. Whether James can ride around those same issues or issues that present themselves, that will define his season. The team is, it's still a very small family-run team. Very, very professional. They stepped up to the mark massively last year with Josh Brooks, and to finish second in the championship was incredible. Whether they can repeat that this year, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that James will have the pace of Messrs. Byrne, Brooks and Haslam. I can't see outside of those three for the championship.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'll happily be wrong. I don't think, for me, Luke Mossy has the talent, but does he have the focus and the drive to put the season together?
It's hard to see a whole season. I can definitely see him as a spoiler.
Yeah. Oh, there's many spoilers, certainly.
And definitely for a win, but a real honest-to-goodness chance to... You know, again, though, having said that, you know, look at Shane last year, injured early on. So
first round.
Missed a few point scoring opportunities. The Ducati itself proved very, very difficult to get it into that very narrow setup window.
There are certainly tracks that it works at, and there are tracks that it doesn't work at. And it's the damage limitation at the tracks that it doesn't work at that will open out Shaky's season. Yeah, he lost 50 points fundamentally from Donington Parks because he crashed in qualifying, knocked himself out, 7-day rule, you can't ride. So he lost a bucket load of points right from round one. Leon lost a lot of potential points with his crash at Knock Hill. You know, he banged himself up there pretty bad. Christian Iden did.
And this is where I think people like the Luke Mossies or the Christian Indians could potentially sneak it, is where they're just racking in consistent finishes.
That's how Josh Brooks did it last year.
One or two of these top riders, you know, has, because, you know, when you have a round that's potentially got three races,
yeah,
you know, that's a whole fistful of points that you can lose out on. So, you know, this is the way I could imagine some of these sort of, other people, Peter Hickman as well. He's another one, I think, who could just, you know, just through pure consistency, close podium and podium finishes,
yeah,
could just sneak this. And then again, this is what I love about it, because, you know, look at last year, going into the last three round, you know, Leon's unfortunately snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, and Shane Byrne stepped up and had an impeccable race weekend and just sealed it at the last minute.
Yeah, and there's nothing to say that not with the same drama, but between those three, I can see it going back down to the final round again for 2018. Leon is as hungry as I've ever seen him. The team are absolutely so tight around him. They've made massive changes within the team of relocating where the bikes are built, where they're looked after, how they're looked after, fundamental changes within the structure of the team, all to suit Leon. And that is going to be a massive help for 2018. Again, there's been a few changes at PBM. Stuart Bland stepped down as team coordinator and Johnny Mowat stepped up to the role. That's continuation within the team. Johnny's been part of the setup for a number of years, was Shaky's crew chief before Giovanni Crupie came in with the new Panigale R. He was Glenn Irwin's crew chief for the last couple of seasons. So he knows what's going on. The three teams, that you would say have the best chance of finishing in the top three, your Beiser Ducati, your JG Speedfit, Bournemouth Kawasaki, and the McCam Yamaha guys, there's been fundamental changes to step them forward into 2018. The biggest change at McCam Yamaha has been Josh Brooks coming into the fold. He is going to give them the extra impetus alongside Stuart Winton, his crew chief. He's brought him along as well. So everything points to it being an incredible year. The two Hondas finished so strongly last year. Jake Dixon showed himself last year to be a force to be reckoned with on his day. As you said, Peter Hickman, he's going to be there or thereabouts. No doubt about that. Glenn Irwin, this is his third season, I think. Yeah, it is. This is his third season. So he's going to come of age. He needs to put a consistent season together and challenge in the top five. And that's where the points are going to be there to be had. I know it sounds really obvious, but the top five will change on a race-by-race basis. And it's who can stay in there the most that will have the biggest chance come the showdown. 5 points for a win, 3 for a second, for 1 point for third. You know, it's all going to count. And I think this year it's going to count more than ever before.
The one question I have for you is, do you think that there are certain manufacturers or bikes that from a performance standpoint will do better than others? I tend to think that a lot of these bikes, the development is driven by World Superbikes. They tend to turn up outside the factory gates with a checkbook and see what bits and bobs they can get from the factory team. So teams with competitive superbike efforts like Ducati, like Kawasaki, like Yamaha, I tend to think that those teams, and certainly those with connections into the factories, have that slight performance advantage. So, you know, when you look at, unfortunately, teams like BMW and Suzuki, do you think they might be struggling, they might be handicapped by not having World Superbike teams?
Yes. Straight answer, yes. Yeah. There will be a factory link between all three of those teams, the red, the green, and the blue. There has to be. The continuity from the World Superbike team to the British Superbike team, they will be using everything in their power to make their bikes the best that they possibly can, whether it's a swing arm pivot, whether it's anything that can help them improve their bike, not necessarily to get one up on their rivals, because each bike is its own merit, if you like. They want to get their bikes the best that they can possibly be. And if that's bringing in parts from other places, yeah, I have no doubt that that's what will happen. And it's all legal and above board. It's nothing underhand. It's getting the best of what's at their disposal. Not having a factory BMW team will potentially hinder Tyco a little bit. They've changed from K-Tech to Ohlins suspension, so that will help them in certain areas as far as bike performance comes along. Honda, I would like to think they would get some return from the Tenkate squad, but that's not a complete factory team, is it? It's still the Tenkate squad.
No, exactly.
It's not a HRC team in that respect.
And then it's Honda UK, isn't it?
And it's Honda UK,
the Honda team as well. So
exactly.
I mean, there's some sort of links, but that you create. It's not the direct pipeline.
But with and that's mainly for hardware. There is no crossover from software at all, because they don't use the rider aids that World Superbikes
do. And it's a different
do.
System, isn't it? It's
Yeah, it's the Motec, yeah, and
it's
they
the
use Magneti Marelli, so there's absolutely no crossover on the software side. It's all down to hardware and rider ability, and I think we're going to see one of the most closely contested British Superbike seasons.
But I am going to take the opportunity to be a complete bar steward and ask you to pick 4, 5, and 6 for the showdown.
Oh, man. Do you know what? I can't.
I just need 3.
Oh, what? Hickman... Linfoot,
are you crazy?
No, I'm not.
I'm just teasing. So Hickman, Linfoot, and the other one?
Oh,
I know, it's so hard, isn't it?
I'm just going to go Brad Ray.
Okay.
And that's no offence to Mossy, Ellison, Irwin, Barrier, Dixon, Bridewell, and Gino Rea, that are the others that are on that list. But Michael Laverty, you know, he's got his best chance in in a good couple of years, two or three years, to reestablish himself at the front of a British superbike field. And I would love him to do that. He's been fantastic on BT Sport and on the MotoGP coverage. Again, it's that rider. That rider eye that we said about that Shane Byrne and Gino Rea over the weekend, having that rider perspective that Hodgie can give, but in an analysis form, Michael Laverty's been amazing for that, and he has a career outside of motorcycle racing, of that I am sure. But for all his efforts, he's not won a championship since the British Supersport Championship in 2006.
I think there's unfinished business in his mind. I think, you know, he needs sort of an opportunity to really prove what he can do. You know, he went to MotoGP, but yeah, on the CRT bikes, and never really got a proper run, a real proper opportunity, I think, to show what he can do. So, yeah. And, you know, one of the other ones, I'm not saying, there's only three places you can't include anyone, Jason O'Halloran.
Exactly.
As well.
Came strong towards the end
of
the season.
I expect the Hondas to be really, really strong. They were a bit on the back foot this time last year. With the bikes slow to turn up, so they weren't able to get the maximum out of testing. And actual fact, I mean, with the weather, not a lot of teams really did get a lot out of testing. So, you know, this Donington, I think, will be the first run where, like I say, everyone gets to see their hands, everyone gets to put the cards on the table.
It's not really going to shake itself down until Alton Park, because you've got Brands Indy next time out, which is... they can't really tell a lot from there. I don't know how well the Panigale works there. It seems to be more the Kawasaki's that work well around that sort of around the Indy circuit. But once we get out of Alton Park, three rounds in before the road racing break, that will give us a little bit of an inclination as to how the top half of the showdown will probably pan out.
And this weekend as well is not looking to be exactly sunny and warm. I just had a quick look at the temperatures, talking like 9, 10 degrees and maybe some showers.
If we're lucky, there's cold air trying to push its way in from the east again, which they were forecasting snow showers originally. So the talk at the test was it's going to snow and we're going to have problems and it's going to be this, that and the other. Weather forecasters can't predict 24 hours in advance. So I'll take Sunday on face value when I open the curtains.
So just to summarise here, I think we've spent about an hour here talking through British Superbikes. We looked at all the different teams, we looked at all the different runners. And to sort of summarise, I think what we're saying is we basically have no idea.
Not a clue.
Not a clue.
But that's the best thing. That's the beauty of the motorcycle racing championships that we have now, is that we don't have a clue. And I don't want to have a clue. I don't want to know that Marc Márquez is going to win the championship, that Shane Byrne's going to win the championship, that Johnny Rea is going to win the championship. It's all up in the air. And just quickly before we finish, if possible, could you put on a link Manuel Pacino, the MotoGP journalist? He's put something together really clever. He's basically got a chart of predicted finishes for the season across each round for the top six riders. So you know that Marc Márquez is going to win at COTA, let's say.
Yeah.
And that Maverick Vinales won at Le Mans. So basically, on the last few seasons, he's based his predictions on where they are. And 364 points for the season is the average championship winning figure. Now, he's really gone into this in depth, and it's something that if you have a read of it, you'll open your eyes to it and you go, like, actually, this is going to be worth following. That the biggest winner out of Qatar was Marc Márquez, because he's already 4 or 7 points better off than he was last year.
Because it wasn't a strong circuit for him. So, he wasn't necessarily even looking to win. He was just more like limiting the damage, which he did beautifully.
Correct. Dovizioso and Rossi are on par score. They're on zero. The biggest loser was Jorge Lorenzo. He's obviously minus 25 already. So if you have a look, if you had a look on the Paddock Chatter Twitter feed, I posted that this morning. You'll find the link on there. So for anybody who wants to have a look at that, go to pacino.com, have a look at that, and it'd be something interesting to follow through the season, and it will almost map out the way that the season's going to be.
And I'll find that link, and I'll include that too with the show notes as well, so people can see that and find that. So we're done, I know, about an hour and 45 minutes. Let's just go for the two-hour show. And if we can, if you don't mind... It's 15 minutes. This is not necessarily on topic, but it's such an interesting, for me, topic. I need to pick your brain. It's GP2.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about that for 15 minutes? GP2, because this is an issue that a lot of race series are having to address or going to find, is the fact that manufacturers are just not making Super Sport 600s anymore.
That's right.
And therefore you have a middle class, you know, a stepping stone. We've got now, we seem to have found that the entry level is some sort of 300 class. That seems to be working really, really well from a cost standpoint, from finding machinery and sort of getting the kids started.
But also getting the manufacturers behind it as well. That's the most important thing about the Supersport 300.
Because the machinery is there because of the Asian market. But we seem to be struggling with this sort of middle step. And I think in the UK, when we're talking about GP2 specifically, which is the new class they've been introduced to run in the British Super Sport Championship, is that two things. So we need, obviously, sort of new, fresh machinery to be a middle class as a stepping stone before going up to Superstock 1000 and potentially Superbikes. But also, you know, a breeding ground that we can help funnel young British riders into that Moto2 vein if they decide to go more sort of MotoGP. Now, you know, traditionally we've had people going out to do CEV in Spain, potentially CIV in Italy, but it makes sense that we have some sort of homegrown Moto2. So I understand, if sort of just paraphrasing, GP2 saying, okay, so we're going to run out along with Superstock, which is a tuned 600s, but you will have a Moto2 prototype custom frame, but with any stock 600 engine you like. And they found that that's kind of comparable on performance. So that's what I've understood that they've put in broadly as the rules.
Yeah, it's going to take a while to come to fruition. There's no doubt about that. But there are, for the teams with the strong back end, certainly Ryan Saxelby, he's put in two bikes out this year with Josh Owens and Jarl Borboom. So if you've got riders that have a good amount of back in that will allow the purchase of the Moto2 machine, there are, after however many years Moto2 has been going, there are machines out there that are
and
available.
At the end of this year, there'll be a whole host because they're changing to Triumph.
Absolutely. So there'll be even more. So they don't have to be the most up-to-date Moto2 machines. They don't have to be the Triumphs of next year. Like you
say, there'll be 675s. So I don't think next year they'll, unless they change the rules, allow that. But there will be a whole stock of current Moto2 machines, Suter, Kalex, you know, speed up frames available. All of them, though, for the Honda engine. So, you know, it's great that they said, well, any 600 engine, but that was one thing. It was hard to see that anybody in the UK would start custom making a Moto2 frame or a GP2 frame for a Yamaha or Kawasaki or other engine.
No, it's all added expense, isn't it? And
yeah.
And the unknown of chassis variables that come with it and the power plant that it's made for. So yeah, I would expect that they would all be the Honda, whether the Geotech or whatever engines that they would, whatever prepared engines they use. I would expect to see in the next 2 years that it becomes a blanket Moto2 championship, a GP2 championship in the UK. As we've seen in World Supersport this weekend, it's Rob Mack's vision of 2003, whatever it was, with his Yamaha R6 Cup that he did in the UK has transposed to world level, and which will potentially transpose to British level as well, with Yamaha only really making a new 600cc bike. And it shows that it's, you know, it's going to be a decent British Supersport season, Ben Curry on the Kawasaki, but I think it's going to be hard to see past Jack Kennedy on the Apple Yard McAdam Yamaha that won the championship last year, obviously, with Keith Farmer. So there's a danger of it going down that road. So to arrest that slide, to bring in the GP2 and to bring the young kids onto the GP2. Josh Owens, I think, is only 17. Jarl Borboom, they're both graduates of British Motostar Championship. So to bring them forward would be ideal, to then possibly go out to CEV if they're quick enough, in the same sense that Tom Booth Amos has done. He ran away with it last year by many, many seconds at most races, and was on the front row and fighting for the win in CEV at Estoril yesterday. So it's, as a talent proving ground, MotoStars working, certainly for Tom, but for Moto2, it would be nice to have that step to go into Moto2 GP if possible, rather than go in Supersport, Supersport, Moto2 in the same breath that Sam Lowes did it, going from British Supersport champion, World Supersport champion, and then into Moto2. There needs to be a step taken out, if you like. World Supersport, it needs more names in it. It's a difficult championship at the moment. Exciting racing yesterday, don't get me wrong, but they were all Yamahas in the top four. So, yes, there's ways and means to do it. It's going to be a long process of a turnaround. But again, they're introducing the Supersport 300s for the kids. So there are three junior, almost, you can't call them the GP2 a junior class per se, but if you've got the likes of Josh Owens and Joel Borboom doing it, then obviously there is a path to follow.
The thing for me with the GP2, though, was I was trying to understand the cost. Because if you're running in the same series as a tuned 600, you know, the Moto2 bikes, like a Kalex machine, you know, you can actually go and find them for sale. And, you know, they're running about sort of €70,000 for a bike and, you know, and a box of spares, some fairings and some other bits and bobs. You know, that seems like a lot of money for a single bike. And if your sort of young star goes and bins it at the first corner, trying to get parts for that is a tough challenge. So, you know, if you are a team with a budget, I was just trying to understand, you know, what would drive you toward the GP2 route and not just sticking with Supersport?
That's a good question. I think I need to, I need to talk to Ryan Saxelby about that as to why he's putting out the GP2. Also, and maybe if I stumble across Mr. Higgs on Sunday, he would be the man to answer that question. Most definitely. Now, whether there is some kind of subsidy coming from MSV for the teams that choose to run them, which is a possibility to encourage teams into the GP2 arena and to eventually phase out the Supersport 600 machines on the production side of things, that could be a possibility. I need to speak, or if anybody listening knows the answer as to why, if any of the guys have contacts in the British Superbike paddock that can answer the question for us, feel free to email in motopod@motopodcast.com rather than me hypothesizing about what may or may not be the case. Please feel free to write in and let us know. That would be a grand gesture from you. Thank you very much. But yeah, if I can find that out over the weekend, I certainly will.
Especially for a midweight, you know, anything that replaces or it has to be cost effective. It has to, you know, there has to be a low cost to entry. I think, you know, it's tougher and tougher trying to find sponsorship and, you know, and pull the money to put these teams together. So, you know, that was the only fear that I had. Like if they made the machinery, which presumably is certainly a portion, if not a large portion of the running costs of a team, that much more expensive, or potentially opened it up to whomever has the, you know, the biggest checkbook, who can go buy the most recent Moto2 machine.
Yeah, it's got to be competitive, hasn't it? There's got to be more than one team to make it a championship. So
yeah,
it'd be interesting to see who lines up on the grid on Sunday afternoon, and Monday afternoon, to see who lines up on the grid on what, because we haven't had really a full test of anything. A lot of the teams are keeping themselves under wraps until it all comes out.
Agreed. I haven't really found, you know, more than one.
No, there's only really been Ryan Saxelby that's pushed it out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so it's going to be.
Having said that, the teams that are running it, they run out of an awning. They don't have the massive hospitality units. They don't have the massive trucks. It'll be maybe the smaller teams that have good backing that want to dip a toe in the water to see what these like Ryan Saxelby, who is an engine tuner extraordinaire, but he's a real proponent of the smaller classes, whether it be MotoStar. It made his name in MotoStar more than anything. So dipping his toe into the water of GP2, is it's a good thing for the series that someone of Ryan's stature in the smaller classes has made that step forward. So whether the likes of Fireplace Warehouse would do that, whether Banks Racing would do that, some of the larger teams within the Moto style, let's say, but they still only operate out of an awning. So they don't have the bigger, the transit costs, the hospitality costs, things like that. So they can put their energies in and finances into the bike. But yeah, there's a big question mark over that at the moment as to the whys and the wherefore. So I'm really intrigued to how that plays out.
But I would really hope that it does in the future open avenues for British riders to come into MotoGP at the Moto2 level, because, you know, we're seeing, I think, you know, with the Sky VR46 Academy, and I think, you know, there's similar type systems in Spain for grooming riders through all the different levels with all the really sort of focused physical training, yeah, rider training, even how to learn English and speak to the press. Really grooming these people, you know, for entry into Moto3 and Moto2. We almost need to have something similar. You know, I sometimes think in the far future that Cal could, you know, retire and set up some sort of like Cal Crutchlow. Although I'd love to see the interview skills that they get taught at that. But anyway, that's by the by. But, you know, it certainly seems like, you know, that's what I think we will need to be doing to have also have British inner riders and not just Britain, you know, but sort of Asian riders as well.
Yeah, it is. That's what you're battling against, though, isn't it? You're battling against the VR46 riders and the Monlau riders and, you know, the guys that have got like a 6-year plan to get into MotoGP, and that'll be his ride in so many years. Then that'll be his ride in so many years. Your younger guys like Tom Booth Amos, Rory Skinner, who's doing the BTC this year, who did the Red Bull Rookies Cup. Charlie Nesbitt's out in CEV at the moment, who won the MotoStar Championship season before last. You know, they're ploughing their furrow in Spain, but they're up against these academy kids that are being brought through right from 5 and 6 years old. Don't get me wrong, Fab Race, there is a junior race series in place in the UK. Cool Fab Racing are doing a fantastic job in bringing the young kids through on the mini bikes, on the Metra kits. Fab Racing have been massive supporters of Bradley Ray over the years and Charlie Nesbitt. So Roger Keyes, Steve Keyes, the guys at Fab Racing have really pushed the youth setup. And they had Scott Redding as well. So there has been a really small but really concentrated, almost rider academy, if you like, through Fab Racing and their setup. But it's been limited to 3 or 4 riders, not the 8, 10, 12 that the Spanish and Italian versions have, and not quite as well publicised. They go about their own business their way. So, yes, there's the young guys, young Josh Bannister, a lot of the BSB teams are getting involved in the paddock bike racing. They get bedecked in WD-40 colours, in JG Speedfit colours. So there's an affiliation to the teams. That is building season on season, but it's such a slow process to be able to make that happen. It's there and it's building, but it's going to be a 5, 6, 8 year plan before we see that come to fruition.
Yeah, and again, I say, this is how I imagine it going, you know, and something similar happening in and around Moto America as well, maybe some sort of brand name races and they're getting involved. Because part of, you know, what these academies are doing, also centralizing a contact point for sponsorship as well. So you don't have individual riders all having to go out, sort of slitting each other's throats, trying to find sponsorship, sure, and bring all that in. You know, you've got the large academies who can have dedicated staff and sort of do the sponsorship details and just allow the riders to do that itself. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because clearly it is a problem in the making that we need to find a solution for. So, you know, that takes us now to the 2-hour mark. I know maybe that was a little bit off topic, you know, for maybe some of the more international listeners. But I think a lot of what we're talking about is sort of local to British, is applicable to, you know, local riders in the States, in Australia, New Zealand, out in the Far East.
Yeah, the setup can work anywhere, can't it?
Yeah. So like I say, we got the first BSB from Donington this weekend.
No, I'm not picking a winner.
I wasn't even going to ask. I thought bad. I still feel bad just asking you for the last three showdown picks.
So hard.
I have a feeling I'll start getting the hate mail after we finish up. I know.
Even Rookie of the Year is going to be a tough one. Mason Law, Kyle Ride, Taron McKenzie. Sylvain Barrier, I was a rookie to BSB.
That doesn't sound quite right, does it? Like, is he? He's in his 30s.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Yeah.
Crash Barrier.
So we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for making some time out of your day. It was great to catch up with you as well. It
Absolute
was great
pleasure.
The fact that you were there at Donington as well to give us some sort of on-the-ground reports. And I know you'll be visiting some of the other races as well, so hopefully we can catch up with each other in the future.
Yeah, very much. I'd love to. They've been grand. Thank you very much for having me back on the show. And it's nice to be back on the sharp end again. And thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you to our listeners. You can find us on facebook.com/motopod. You can look for us as well at motopodcast.com. If you like what you hear, then you can look me up on Twitter at @Andy_course. If you have any complaints, you can write to our complaint department. That is Dave at motopodcast.com. Dave's also on Twitter at Dave Neal. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your week. And will you be working over the race weekend, or you have some time to put your feet up, crack a beer, and watch?
I've booked Monday off. My holidays are all taken up this year with racing and with a little trip to New York in the summer. So, I should be watching the racing on Monday, but from the comfort of my sofa after getting probably piss wet through and freezing cold all day on Sunday at Donington Park. So we will be there at least part of the weekend, yeah.
Outstanding. Yeah, on one corner. So you'll know what happens at one corner, then you can go watch it on Monday and actually find out what happened in the race.
Fuck that, I'll be in a garage. If it's raining, I'm staying undercover.
Okay, well, it just remains for me to say thank you very much, and that's goodbye from him.
And goodbye from me.
Cheers, Dave. Take care.
Cheers, Andrew. Thanks a lot, mate.